This is Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program that explores the music and the artists behind the 2017 season of the Aspen Music Festival and School and previews upcoming performances. I'm Chris Moore. This program comes to you from Aspen Public Radio, the official voice of the Aspen Music Festival and School, and can be heard online at aspenpublicradio.org. Funding for Festival Showcase is provided by the Barnard Fane Foundation. We're in the midst of our summer pledge drive, so if you enjoy our conversations today, please pledge your support to Aspen Public Radio right now at 970-920-9000 or on our secure website at aspenpublicradio.org. Today's a busy week. We have 5 artists to interview, including soprano Renee Fleming, who sings at the Tent on July 30th, Enon Barnaton, who premieres Alan Fleming's new piano concerto on the same concert, composer Alan Fletcher himself, and piano competition winner Avery Galliano, who performs Mozart's 25th piano concerto tomorrow evening. But first, let's hear from mezzo-soprano Michelle DeYoung, who premieres Timothy Collins' Desdemona, Du Parc songs, and Mahler's Rückertlieder tonight at Harris Hall.
You're putting on an unusual program when you come to Aspen, the one on the 25th of July, because there's going to be a world premiere, and then music of Du Parc, which not too many people know, and of course Mahler. Can you say a little bit about the Collins piece that's going to be the world premiere for starters?
Well, it's a string quartet, and it's based on the Boito Othello, and it's her big scena with the Ave Maria, where she's foreboding her death, I feel, in some ways. Mm-hmm. It's a fantastic piece. He writes so beautifully for the voice and for my voice. It's different little sections, but the whole piece is only 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. And you hear the drama throughout the string quartet and also throughout what I'm singing. It's set so beautifully, the way it's...
It must be challenging for the composer and, of course, also for you as someone who's very familiar with Verdi and Othello to use the same Boito text and come up with something that doesn't just sound like Verdi in some way. Like it would seem like that would be a very large black hole.
It's so interesting. It doesn't sound anything like Verdi.
Oh, that's great.
I think he really has the ability to go into what she is saying. It's not that he doesn't know the Verdi. It's that he's able to create it the way he hears it and feels it, and it's totally different.
Tell us a little bit also about the other two pieces that you're singing.
The neat thing about the concert, it involves string quartet, it involves piano, it involves me. So we have different pieces. The first piece is string quartet and I. Then the second half, we have the Mahler and the Du Parc, and that's piano and I. And then mm-hmm. we actually will have an encore that will include all of us. So I love the programming of it. I think it's so interesting. And then the Mahler, the Rückertlieder, they're just 5 gems. Each one is incredibly special, ending with probably the one of the most powerful pieces of all Lieder, Ich bin der Welt. Abhanden gekommen. It's an incredible song cycle. And each song, they don't link together like Songs of the Wayfarer, but each song is very special within itself and beautiful poetry.
That last song you were talking about, is that the one if it translates to something like I am leaving the world or I'm
yes.
leaving the world behind, a kind of a
yeah, exactly.
resignation, despair, the world didn't offer me what I had hoped it would, that kind of sentiment.
Yeah, it's saying that the world doesn't think I'm around anymore, but the truth is, it's sort of right. In some mm-hmm. ways, I'm not, because I want to go away from the world's turmoil. I want to live alone in my love and in my life, or in my song. So it's a very, very powerful piece. So that will be ending it, because you can't really sing something after that.
No.
And then we'll have the 3 Du Parc. They are not put together for any other reason than I think they are nice together. L'Invitation Voyage is quite popular for Du Parc, but Extase and Elegie are not so well known. So I think it's interesting to put those on as well.
I understand you're also going to be doing a master class, and you've done several of them here. You're one of the more unusual ones. If you as a listener have a chance to watch her do a master class, I'm not sure, but when you have a singer walk backwards or do something that's maybe not necessarily directly related to a vocal technique, but at least get some thinking outside of the box or experiencing their process of singing in a different way. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're trying to do and why you surprise singers with very unconventional approaches?
Most of the physical things I do, if I make them run backwards, if I push them into a wall, if I make them jump, the biggest problem in my experience of people learning how to sing opera is not knowing how to support. Because we don't sing with microphones, we have to really support with our body. And many, many singers, especially young singers, just take like a normal breath and sing. And that's just not enough. We have to have our diaphragm down and we have to have our entire body engaged. So I'm trying to get them more energetic and more engaged into their support.
In so doing, well, for one thing, I have to say it's very entertaining for us as audience members to watch that. But do you see actual differences in the sound quality of what the singers produce the second time they try to sing the same aria?
Yes, because they start to feel how it feels.
Mm-hmm.
So if, like, say if they're jumping up and down and they start to feel the lower support just from the jumping, then they start to feel the release of what it's like to have the whole voice engaged as opposed to just the top of the voice or the top of the body engaged.
Mm-hmm.
And it is so much easier to sing when you have all of the support, because then all of the pressure comes off of the throat and it goes onto the support.
As a teacher in general, not just at the master classes, what are some of the most rewarding things just in general that you discover with a singer? What are the things that where your eyes just light up and you say, oh, this is so worth it to teach? What is it you're hoping for them ultimately to see and to express and transmit?
Well, you know, I don't have any full-time students because I travel so much, but
mm-hmm.
I do a lot of master classes. Sometimes I get to see them again afterwards, or they write me and they, you know, will say, can you explain this to me or explain that to me? I think the most rewarding thing as a voice teacher is to see somebody understand something and improve because of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so in master classes, I don't think I'm going to change anybody's life or change anybody's technique or anything like that. But what I feel like my job is in that 20 minutes of working with them is to say, this is something you need to work on. This is a way you can work on it. You need to find someone to teach you that. And I give them an idea of what it's like, and they like it. I mean, sometimes you get singers that just don't want to change anything, and
right. So
then they're not open to it. But it's very, very rare that a singer won't be very open and excited and want to change something, because that's why they're there. You know, it's not an audition. It's to work. I find it very rewarding.
Now, well, as an interviewer, I'm not drawing out very much a whole other side of you that I see in master classes, which is your sense of humor, your incredible sense of humor. So I have to ask at the end if you could perhaps share some of the funnier stories of some of the things that have happened to you on stage or off stage, for that matter, in the course of your opera career.
When I was a young artist at the Met, I did one of the Cretan women in Idomeneo, which is just a small bit part. It's a soprano and a mezzo. The soprano was Emily Pooley, and the Idomeneo was Placido Domingo. And the staging was that Emily and I were facing the audience, but really we were facing Domingo, and he was facing us, so the audience could not see him. We had these dresses on that were quite fit. They were quite fitted and tight.
Mm-hmm.
And the front had little buttons that went all the way down. And I took a deep breath, and the button covering my chest popped off. And I'm a young artist. I'm totally shy. Domingo slowly just looks down and just stares there. And I had to just keep looking at him. I don't know if my dress was wide open. I don't know what's happened. But I was humiliated. Anyway, we walk off stage, and he comes up to me and says, Michelle, I would like you to do that every night.
That's great. I had to ask, because I know that no matter how serious an opera is, and also, obviously, a lot of people who do very, very serious opera, as you do, you've got to blow off the steam somehow at the end of the day.
Yeah. Well,
and
the
just
funniest
the
person
company.
I've worked with is Jane Eaglin. We laughed and laughed and laughed, and always do.
You know, I wouldn't have necessarily guessed that, and I think that's partly because she is so serious on the stage and does such serious roles.
Oh, she's hilarious.
That's great to hear. Thank you very much, and we look forward to seeing you up here in Aspen yet again for the recital and the masterclass.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to it.
If you've just joined us, we've been talking with mezzo-soprano Michelle DeYoung, who sings tonight at Harris Hall. We are in the midst of our summer pledge drive, so if you enjoy our conversations today, please pledge your support to Aspen Public Radio right now at 970-920-9000 or on our secure website at aspenpublicradio.org. Next, a brief conversation with 16-year-old piano competition winner Avery Galliano, who performs Mozart's 25th piano concerto tomorrow evening at the Tent. Since you're playing Mozart's 25th piano concerto tomorrow, and I've also seen you on YouTube playing other Mozart pieces, tell me how you feel about Mozart, or the connection you feel to Mozart's music.
Growing up, I think I always had a special connection to Mozart. I don't like
mm-hmm.
to say. I know some musicians say that they have a very special, you know, affiliation with one composer,
mm-hmm.
and I like all composers. But I definitely, growing up, played many Mozart compositions, and I hopefully have a good understanding of his music and his style. Of course, everybody's interpretation is different, and I can respect everybody's individuality in their playing. For me, I just love Mozart because of the playfulness, and at the same time, the amount of emotion behind the playful facade. He has so much expression, and at the same time, he always inserts little moments of reality checks, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, you can hear him laughing in the places, you know, it seems serious, but then all of a sudden, he's like, just kidding, you know? And that's very Mozart. I think that's what I love so much about him. It's so playful, and at the same time, so serious.
When you play, the way your hands move on the piano almost reminds me a little bit of dance. Do you feel a sense of dance and the rhythm of dance in your music making and actually in the movement of your hands as well?
In a way, yes. I never thought about it that way, and it's nothing I do on purpose. But it's interesting because my teacher here, Arye Vardi, he did talk about how the way you play physically is the way your piano will sound. So it was very interesting for me to hear that because I realized if you're relaxed and if you move, then your music will also move and your music will also flow. So I try to be as natural as possible when I play. I try to stay away from very forced motions.
We've been talking with pianist Avery Galliano, who performs Mozart's 25th piano concerto tomorrow evening at the Tent. We're in the midst of our summer pledge drive, so if you enjoy these conversations today, please pledge your support to Aspen Public Radio today as well at 970-920-9000 or on our secure website at aspenpublicradio.org. The big concert of the week is coming up this Sunday with the Aspen Festival Orchestra. Robert Spano conducts, pianist Enon Barnaton premieres Alan Fletcher's piano concerto. I talked with both Enon and Alan, and by the way, later on, Renee Fleming. But now, Enon and Alan talking about this new work.
Let's talk about Alan Fletcher a little bit, because he told me earlier in the season, he said one of the things that was very exciting for him, having you as the pianist, he said, Enon Barnaton can play anything. So implying that if he wanted to write something very, very lyrical or something very pounding and forceful and raging or whatever direction he wanted to go, in a sense, you were almost a clear palette for him. Except that he also knows some of the kinds of music you like to play, and that certainly influenced him. Can you tell us a little bit about which parts of you as a musician are being brought forth in this particular piano concerto by a man who knows you and your musicianship very well?
You know, it's interesting because I was thinking about this as I was learning this concerto, because I think a lot of composers say that when they write a piece for a specific musician that they have that musician in mind, mm-hmm. and it means different things for different composers. Here, I actually really do think, and I haven't spoken to him yet about this, but I suspect I can hear different influences from things that I have played in the past, for example, in Aspen, or things that he knows that I love, and whether it's I recorded a lot of Schubert, for example, and there are some turns of phrases and harmonies that really remind me of Schubert. There's the end of a piece. The concerto actually reminds me of a piece that I played the last time I played recital in Aspen. That was my encore, a Mendelssohn Rondo Capriccioso, and mm-hmm. there's something very similar in the way that it's written, and that actually, I did ask Alan, he did confirm that was something that made him think of that particular texture, and he wrote that as a reference to that, to my Mendelssohn performance, and I think there are quite a few things in the piece that our personal connection that either he has to something that I've done or something that I have connection to, and he's been very creative in the way that he puts that into the piece.
One of the grave dangers of a world premiere is that a tremendous amount of work went into it by Alan Fletcher, of course, in the composing of it. A lot of work goes into it from your standpoint in terms of getting it under your fingers and into your mind. And then there's always the danger that it never gets performed again. Do you have plans to perform this piece a second time somewhere else?
A second and a third. In September, I'll be playing it with the Los Angeles Philharmonic in mm-hmm. the Hollywood Bowl. Mm-hmm. And then later in the season, I'll be playing it in Atlanta with Bob Spano, conductor, of course, who's the mm-hmm. music director in Aspen, also music director of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra, and I'll be doing that during their season. And you're absolutely right, that's always a danger with premieres, is that they get heard once and never done again. And I always try and avoid that. Even the last concerto that I did a European premiere of by Andrew Norman, I then repeated it with two or three other orchestras since, because I feel like these pieces need to have a life beyond the premiere.
Knowing Alan Fletcher, as many of us do, he actually is kind of a quiet heart, spends a lot of time alone composing, of course, when he's able to, kind of goes into retreat. And a lot of his music has a quality of lyricism and introspection. And I think of a piano concerto as being a rather grand work and a rather extroverted work. How does Alan Fletcher, from your point of view as a performer of this work, approach the piano concerto, considering sort of his musical personality?
Interestingly enough, he brings those qualities to the piano concerto, even though there are many moments that are grand. And naturally, I haven't heard it with the orchestra yet, but from my interaction with the piece, there are many moments that are grand and epic, but he brings a lot of intimacy and lyricism to the piece. The piece even starts with a very kind of lyrical, intimate passage for the piano alone, as much in a way that Beethoven's Fourth Concerto did.
Yes.
I think there's almost a deliberate attempt to rethink or to kind of turn what we think a concerto is on its head sometimes. But there's no lack of drama and confrontation, but a lot of it does seem very lyrical and tonal and beautiful. So I think he's exploring different aspects of what it means to write a concerto.
Well, let's explore a little bit your August 2nd recital at 8:30 at Harris Hall. I look at it and I see Bach, Handel, Rameau, Couperin, so lots of Baroque music. And then right after that, you have Ravel's Tombeau de Couperin. You have a prelude and fugue, I think, of Brahms. Is this kind of a Baroque-y sort of concert where the Baroque influences touch the composers who follow from later periods?
Absolutely. The first half of the recital is basically a Baroque suite. The kind of instrumental suite was the very first concert music, really. It developed from dance music of the courts, and the composers then developed them into the first really instrumental music. And they usually had this very recognizable format where you'd have a collection of short dances or pieces, starting from a prelude and then having the Allemande, the German dance, and then a Courante, which is a French dance, and a Saraband, etc., etc. They had this structure, but of course, great composers, as soon as they adopted the structure, they proceeded to tear it down and pour a lot of their genius into that format. And what I wanted to do is to take that basic structure and have every one of those little pieces by a different composer, starting from Bach and Handel, continuing through to 20th century and 21st century composers that were influenced by Baroque composers.
And here is composer Alan Fletcher. Other composers I've talked to, when they write either an opera or a piano concerto, they swear they're never going to do it again because it's so many notes. What was it like for you? Because it's probably in some ways even bigger than writing a symphony in terms of the sheer amount of time that it takes to put the notes down on paper.
Especially writing for Enon Barnaton. Enon has already, in his very young life, really great string of concertos that he's premiered and championed. And so the opportunity to write for him imposes or offers, whichever you like, an obligation on the composer. It had better be good. It had better be worth his time because he's going to spend a lot of time. I'm not so worried about all the notes, but Enon has to be worried about all the notes because he's got a lot of them to play. And also the fact that we had settled that it would be on a Sunday and thus a very large orchestra. It could easily have gone differently. At the same time, I was writing a concerto for Daniel Hope and the Zurich Chamber Orchestra, New Century Chamber Orchestra. And that one, by contrast, Daniel had said, there will only be 10 violins, five violas, four cellos, et cetera. It'll be a very small ensemble. But for Enon, we knew it was going to be big. So yeah, one starts out thinking a concerto this size and for an artist of this importance needs to be making a statement.
I don't think of you as a composer who does a lot of flashy, virtuosic stuff. Your music has more of a kind of a lyrical quality, kind of a inward-looking quality. I'm wondering how much the element of virtuosity is there, because you do have a big orchestra, a big audience, and a pianist who could do just about anything.
Yep.
When you were thinking about how to put this together, were there places in it where you felt it was appropriate to integrate actual virtuosity into it rather than just maybe lyricism or other elements?
Yeah, it's a very big piece. It's very, very difficult. I was meeting Enon in Miami, Florida at an event where he played for us, and he was touring with Academy of St. Martin in the Fields. After the concert with the Academy, we sat down for a late dinner, and I presented him with his score for the first time. The first thing he did was turn to the last page, and he said, "Thank you." I said, "Thank me." And he said, "Thank you for writing a really big ending." It's one of very many questions for any concerto composer, but especially the piano concerto, because the pianist is doing something very unlike anyone else in the orchestra.
Right.
And so there's an obvious opposition between them, but is it going to end big or not? There are extremely important concertos that end quietly. Is it going to start with a big orchestra flourish or not? And there are great concertos that do that, and there are great ones that don't. Is it going to start with the piano alone or not? Similarly, there are many important examples where concertos do. And so those were all big questions.
One of the world's most loved sopranos, Renee Fleming, sings at the same concert July 30th. Here she is about talking about Aspen, as well as the song she has chosen for this Sunday's concert.
It appears that you have a soft spot for Aspen because, of course, you can sing wherever you want, and this is your second year at least in a row that you've come up here. Can you say a little bit about why you enjoy coming up here or what convinces you to come back?
Well, Aspen was my training ground. Spent several summers in Aspen. Actually, I'm a skier, but I've never been there in the winter. I've come back and sung at the Aspen Music Festival from time to time. For much of my career, I spent summers in Europe because I could. Children were in school during the year, and that made the most sense. But now I'm freer to kind of do what I want in the summers, and I really love coming back. You know, also the music festival is spectacular and such high quality.
I had heard rumors that you used to bicycle up to the Maroon Bells, which is a pretty steep bicycle ride.
Yes, I did that almost every day for a couple of years and loved it, absolutely loved it. Obviously, on the way up is a lot harder than on the way
yes,
down.
Yes, it is. You have an unusual program. Michael Tilson Thomas, who's well known as a conductor, and we know he is a composer, but most people don't know his music, and Bjork. Can you tell us what those pieces mean to you, what the songs are that you chose to sing for us, and why you chose them?
Well, I premiered these pieces in 2002, and Michael is a friend of mine, besides being such a fabulous musician and conductor and composer. And I recently just said, we should start doing these again because they're really terrific songs. And so I sang them with him in Miami last year. You know, the Aspen Music Festival was represented there, and they requested specifically that I do these pieces. So this was actually the idea of the festival, and I thought it would be good to pair it with the Bjork songs which I recorded because they're new and they're fresh and there's something really wonderfully summery on it.
Well, a title like All Is Full of Love, it actually reminds me of All You Need Is Love by the Beatles, but also just, and of course this is a pop singer who has a very serious and deep ability to write music or write songs. So
absolutely, and she's a soprano, and I think her work is incredibly creative. So I loved kind of going through the song, getting the music, and getting to know it a little better.
One of the challenges in Aspen, besides being at almost 8,000 feet, of course, is that instead of the orchestra being kind of safely down in the pit, where you just can sing over them pretty easily, the orchestra is right there with you. Do you find that to be an extra challenge, or is it more fun for you to have the orchestra right there so you feel more intimacy with the orchestra as you're singing?
Oh, I love it. To me, it's better this way because my favorite collaboration is with a conductor and orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
So we're collaborating in a much more direct way. When I'm performing in a production that has the orchestra in the pit, I have almost no contact with anybody. They can hear me, but it's not as direct.
I also think of you as an ambassador for opera, or as an ambassador for singing. And, of course, you've done things singing way out of context from opera at all. And now you have a kind of a new career, as it seems, as an interviewer at the Med-HDs, interviewing your own best friends.
I love doing that, yeah.
I wanted to ask about that.
That's been fun. But I think that where I'm spending most of my time in terms of work outside of singing is at the Kennedy Center.
Mm-hmm.
We just finished a project with the National Institutes of Health. And that was a fascinating look at music in the brain, and I'm hoping to continue that work. And I've been a consultant to Lyric Opera of Chicago for 6 years, and that's been really exciting, just presented Chicago Voices and bringing all these different genres together in a big, wide-ranging program, celebrating just vocal artistry, really, from rap to gospel and everything in between. I'm really loving having the opportunity to do these different things and celebrate singing. I'm a singer-phile, for sure.
Definitely. And how do you see the importance of maintaining your health for all of us Americans, but also for the singers, that your colleagues, the students, and your master classes? How does health play into the health of the voice when they're standing up on the stage?
Well, it's definitely related. You can't withstand the rigors of the career, which require travel, a lot of flying, and stamina without maintaining your health. We don't get paid if we don't sing. So even a cold or a throat infection can mean that you can't pay your rent. So it's very important that you're healthy. And I have always felt that there's a very strong mind-body connection. We couldn't learn how to sing, for instance, if we weren't very intuitive about the body and able to coax it into submission, because singing requires the use of mostly involuntary muscles. So It's complicated. And add to that the fact that each voice, each person, each human being is different. So I love it. It's a quite mysterious instrument, and one that elicits chills and thrills and also elicits a recognizability. You know, each voice you recognize in a couple of bars if it's a very distinctive sound. So these are some of the things that I think about a lot and try to share with the audience.
The other aspect, of course, is the whole theatrical level. You're focusing so much on your voice, in a sense, making your involuntary muscles voluntary again. And at the same time, one of the things that I think you bring to the stage so much is a very naturalistic approach to sing, quite the opposite of the stereotypes, I guess, of operatic singers. Can you say a little bit about how you commit yourself theatrically to a character and drown into that character?
When I was singing, for instance, Violetta in La Traviata, which I sang her that role for 10 years and really loved it. She's an incredibly grateful part. The audience loves her. I always felt that I was in my prime and doing the best that I could do if I forgot that I was singing, and the audience could forget that I was singing, and in fact it was a play. So that was always a goal of mine, and I learned that also from the great Magda Oliveira, an Italian singer who I once asked very late in her life if she was nervous to go back to singing after taking 10 years off, and she said, no, I wasn't nervous at all. I didn't think of myself as a singer. I thought of myself as an actress, and I thought that was so fascinating, and I understood what she meant. And what I tell young singers is that your focus and devotion to technique will free you. It's only with an exquisite technique that you can execute what your imagination tells you. And that's a complete freedom. So young singers tend to think it's the opposite, that they want to get away from technique and become an artist. And, you know, I encourage them to definitely spend that time.
So on that Thursday morning, July 27th, when you do a master class with the students here in Aspen, are you going to be focusing then mostly on technique to make sure that they have that mastery of technique so that then they can give their hearts to the characters?
Oh, thank you for mentioning that. Yeah, I hope everybody comes. I, in a master class, I try to keep it a little bit broader than that because there's an audience, and I want the audience to also be able to take away a lot of different aspects of what we do. But I'll try to touch on a lot of things. So definitely technical issues, which we most of us still have and continue to work on. I always tell people, you know, I'm still a work in progress. I'm always learning something. It's so complicated to learn about not just the voice, but also, as you said, the communication with the audience and the presentation, and, you know, there are a million things to think about at once. It's a great challenge.
These young students have a very big future ahead of them, and you too have, I hear you going on to the Broadway stage. Can you tell us about some of the musical projects?
Well, Carousel is number one. I mean, that's going to take an enormous amount of time, and I've made a commitment to the Broadway stage, as you said, and I'll get to sing You'll Never Walk Alone 8 times a week.
Right.
I hope everybody who hears this makes the trek to New York to come and see the show, because it's so beautiful. I feel privileged to join that extraordinary tapestry of performers, and to have that opportunity also as somebody who's sung consistently opera and classical music to cross over into another genre, but at the very top of the field is extraordinary. It's a great opportunity.
We've been talking with soprano Renee Fleming about Aspen and her upcoming concert, July 30th at the Tent. This has been Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program that explores the music and the artists behind the 2017 season of the Aspen Music Festival and School and previews upcoming performances. This program comes to you from Aspen Public Radio, the official voice of the Aspen Music Festival and School, and can be heard online at aspenpublicradio.org. Join me Tuesdays at 3:30 or on our website as well. My name is Chris Moore. Thanks for listening.